Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know you may find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub, as well as iTunes and now Google Play. I'm very excited, as I am every episode, and very appreciative to have Rhoda Baeza, editor at Imprint, which is part of Macmillan, and also the author of The Empress of a Thousand Skies duology, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Welcome, Rhoda.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I was telling Rhoda before I hit the record button that she's the trifecta. Packager, editor, author. So I think you have this kind of even more expansive knowledge, and I kind of want to touch on that, especially in the first question, because I really appreciated and enjoyed your interview on Zeta's blog. Mm-hmm. She was a previous guest, and she talked to you and also previous guest Danielle Clayton about book packaging and the reality of book packaging. And it was interesting because both of you didn't have competing perspectives, but it wasn't as though everything you thought was in line with the other. So, like, when it came to awards, you both had kind of separate thoughts, processes, and how it actually works to help uplift a writer's career. Before you were at the book packager, Paper Lantern Lit, which is now Glasstown Entertainment, I believe, you were also a writing instructor, and you had a bunch of other jobs.
I did, yeah.
So how did you actually work your way into book packaging?
Yeah, you know, it was a pretty unconventional path. So before I grew up in Southern California, and I wasn't even aware that, you know, much less book packaging, but any kind of job in publishing was available. Like a lot of people outside of the industry, I thought that maybe there was just copy editors who caught grammar and typos, and that was it. It just did not seem like a viable future for me. I didn't know anything about it. So I bounced back and forth between nonprofit and tech. I worked at Planned Parenthood initially, and I was community educator there. And then I moved to Seattle, and I got into tech, and then I left tech, and I got back into social work, working with homeless teens specifically as a writing instructor. And that was around maybe the height of Twilight. But also, I was working with a very specific population of youth who essentially was looking for mirror books for them and had a lot of trouble finding them. Which is not to say that they didn't exist. There were plenty out there. But as someone who was totally unfamiliar with publishing and as, you know, looking into an industry that's totally rigged against people of color and narratives that honestly portray different kinds of dynamics and poverty that are involved with that, I just had no idea what it was doing, basically. So I went into this deep dive of research, and I think one of my starting points was Cindy Pond's blog, The Diversity in YA, and I went from there, and I kind of fell hard and fell in love with it, and started reading alongside a lot of my students and looking for more and more books to give them. Then when the opportunity came to move to New York, I actually got in touch with one of the Glasstown founders. You know, at this point, I was not old, but maybe 28. And so they were looking for an intern. And I was like, should I start a career again? Should I do this? And I had already started too and kept bouncing around. I also was freelancing already, still doing tech writing work because, as we all know, publishing is not an easy industry to survive in at entry level. And that was what made it happen. That's what gave me the privilege to do that, is that I was still doing tech writing and then I was interning for Paper Lantern. So I did that for maybe 6 or 7 months until a full-time position opened up.
Well, may I ask if the internship was paid or was it unpaid?
It was paid, but, you know, as many interns. Yeah. It wasn't anything that I could sustain myself on, especially in New York. I mean, you know, I think a lot about the entry level salary, especially because I am a full-time editor now, as well as a writer, but as a full-time editor at a house.
Another friend of mine, she told me, she was like, have you thought of getting into technical writing? It pays very well. And I said, I don't want to do that at this point in my career. But I also have the leverage not to do that.
Right. Right. I mean, I don't have to do it anymore, so I don't.
But it's kind of a good alternative, or like a freelance alternative, do you think?
I think some people, I really like technology. Mm-hmm. I've always liked the way it influenced culture. I thought that I wanted to be a tech journalist. That was an alternate reality and a dream and a plan at some point when I was younger. So I knew that I liked it and I wanted to be involved in it, but ultimately I didn't. You know, it was interesting. You know, it's why I like science fiction, but it wasn't, it's just not where my heart was. And mm-hmm. so it was a really nice stepping stone and a really great kind of financial bedrock to start another career, which was frankly like my third career, right? Mm-hmm. You know?
And that's kind of, I like to talk about that with, you know, last year I had the WNDB interns on and we're talking to them about how they were maintaining. The grant helped a lot, but at the same time, how do you maintain a life in New York City on an internship salary?
I have no idea.
Yeah. And what are the alternatives that they can find to try and kind of keep themselves afloat? Because I know some agents who have second jobs because they don't always make money from agenting itself.
Right. And is there, you know, potential to live remotely?
Yeah.
An intern for a New York publishing house or another publishing house, right? Yeah. I mean, there's also publishing jobs everywhere, like not just in New York, which I think is always really important to remember, but it's rough. It's really, really rough for the young people entering.
Upside, if you do know social media or are a good fan of it, a lot of places are willing to give. I mean, that's my side gigs are making money doing social media.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you find the work? In terms of Paper Lantern, now Glasstown Media, okay, this is exactly what I want to do. I love exactly what I'm doing. Or it really helps steer you more towards what you saw your role in publishing being.
Right. Oh, so I loved a lot of it. I thought it was creatively, intensely demanding in the way that I like.
Okay.
It's your job to come up with pitches and to build worlds and to think about characters and interaction and plot things. And I absolutely loved that marriage of this creative side versus this rigid kind of, not rigid, but creativity graft to a structure. I think that's where I work the best. I think if you just gave me a blank slate and I could do anything I wanted, I would freeze up. Whereas if you gave me too much, if the parameters were too tight, then I would feel really, really hemmed in. So I thought that from a creative perspective, it was really, really such an important education for me, for sure. And it's called a book packager, and I think that's like literally what you're doing, is that you're thinking about how to package a book. So not just the structure and the content, but also its positioning in the market and what other competitive titles are like. And that was a very, very important kind of mindset to be into, especially when you move over to a publishing house. I think that the strategy, if that's a thing that you like, is publishing is really great for that, because you're continually trying to innovate and look for new ways to market and position books and get people excited about them. And I think it's totally fair, like, for some writers who frankly are just don't want to think about it or are not good at it or want to be shielded from it. Like, that's your more power to you, and like lots of self-care. But I think that, you know, for me, I was super curious about all of that because I had bounced around so many industries and I wanted to see how this other one worked. So it was cool to look at it from that perspective, because you are doing, you're doing a lot of editing, but you're also doing a lot of creative development. And there's an element of agenting involved, because you are getting to know editors at houses who you can submit these projects to. I thought it was, I mean, like I said, it was a very, very important education and a really, really great primer. I think some people stay in publishing, and that's great. It was hard for me, not publishing, I meant packaging, but it was hard for me, I think, to work full time as a packager and then also write my own books. Because then it felt like that creative energy kind of got siphoned off into too many different areas.
Gotcha.
So when that started to become demanding, then I thought that, you know, this was a very, coming here to imprint at Macmillan felt like a very logical step, you know? And I think in a lot of ways it really suited me, because Glasstown has a very commercial kind of quality to it. And I mean that in like a really good way. I love commercial things. I love things that move quickly and are engaging to read and super, super voicey. So that felt really natural for me to kind of fit into that role and that environment. But what I loved about the transition is then I got to build my own list and blend, you know, the commercial and the literary and kind of books that are hard to pitch or kind of weird or also like really tightly focus on publishing writers of color and making those decisions for myself, you know? And I thought that that was, this has been like a really kind of great opportunity to do stuff like that too.
So you were saying that you like kind of the commercial, the voice, all that stuff. So do you think working at what was formerly Paper Lantern Lit helped kind of navigate your tastes in a way, or that your tastes were already established and it kind of just broadened in terms of?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, they kind of feel like the two sides of the same coin, because I felt like that's what my heart of heart wanted to read, was just the kind of fast paced, accessible magic systems and action, and you know, and that's what I like writing. But also I had come up in this, publishing was this really kind of far away ivory tower to me, but I'd always loved reading and I'd always loved writing. But a lot of my education prior to coming to New York and even prior to starting to work was just like reading canon adult literary. And so, and then that's like kind of very, can be anti-intersectional, which is not to say that I don't still love a slow burn literary novel, because I do. I love them a lot. But I also think that there was something really empowering and exciting about kind of opening up this other genre to me. And part of that exploration was working with these kids when I was at the homeless shelter and seeing what they responded to, and not just like what got them excited, but also what spoke to them. So,
and in addition, as mentioned, to being an editor, you're an author. And I don't think I've had too many author editors on the podcast thus far. In terms of your writing process, do you, is there a switch that goes off and I'm not editing this, I am writing this? Or do you kind of self-edit as you go?
So it's the former. Like, I, you didn't get to see me, audience, but I was like nodding emphatically when she was like, is there a switch? And I'm like, yes, because there's no way I would be able to finish a book if I tried to self-edit as I went. And actually, I did that for, I don't know, 15, 20 years, which is why I'd never written anything that could sell, you know, I think personally, which is not to kind of take away from anyone else's self-editing process. But for me, I need to write a very bad zero draft before I can improve it. And it gets improved incrementally. It gets built in revision, right? So even if I make a really, really big change midway through the book, I don't want to go and revise the first half of the book. I would rather just keep writing it and make notes. And because so much of my job is getting into the nitty gritty and the editing and the structuring and plotting out three acts and all of those things I really love doing, I like to do that from my own books too, but I just want a whole clean draft, even if it's a mess. Because I can work with a mess, but I can't work with a quarter of a manuscript that I keep revising and revising and revising. I do have that in me to just keep tweaking something for 7 or 8 years. And I just, I need to get a draft down, like first and foremost.
And what happens after that zero draft?
Then it, so my zero draft is usually like super short and like messy as hell, you know, it like barely,
as it should be.
It barely, it doesn't make sense. I really don't think a third party could read it and know what was going on, but basically it's a skeleton of a draft. There's kind of the seeds of emotion and stuff, but it's more like, this is where I think they are in the world, and you know, this is what their movement is and this is what their motivations are. And then after that, then you start building in and layering in what they love, what they think about, who they wish they could be, what they're hiding from themselves. And it just like kind of just, I mean, every draft I write, like I said, the first one's really short, so I end up adding like 10,000-15,000 words to every single draft. And then I throw a bunch of them away and add some more, and that's when chapters start getting cut and rearranged and then put back in, you know, mm-hmm. new ones are plotted and things like that. But hopefully you get the plot in a good enough shape where you're not rearranging things anymore. And then you're just adding character and then after characters, like texture and mm-hmm. world. And
So like building a body, like the bones and the muscle.
That's definitely my process. I know that there are other authors who are really good about, they need to feel really good about the chapter before they move on to the next one, mm-hmm. which I think is really cool. I've just tried it and it doesn't work for me.
Yeah. That's me.
Yeah.
Then when do you get time to write? Because you're editing. And editing, as I've spoken to and even know, it is not a 9-to-5 part of your job.
Yeah.
Like, you are not necessarily in your office as soon as you come in and editing.
Yeah.
Sitting there editing a book. No. You might not edit it at all.
Yeah.
Once you're in the office.
Yeah. In the office, you're taking care of a bunch of other mm-hmm. things. The thing about editing is that the more books you acquire, the more things that you have to do outside of actually editing the books, mm-hmm. The craft of the books. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I figure it out. I find the time. I mean, I make time during the day or, you know, during the week so that I have blocks of time where I'm, like, reading and working mm-hmm. and, you know, crafting these editorial letters because mm-hmm. those feel like kind of their own special projects onto themselves.
It's deep.
But I like
editorial letters are deep.
Yeah, yeah. I love working on those. I love editing. I love that part of my job. And I do work for my editorial job mm-hmm. outside of my 9-to-5 hours. And mm-hmm. then I'm also writing. But I write in revision sprints. So this is another thing about me that I wish I was kind of better about. But it's not like I have a word count that I hit daily. Sometimes I just know, like, the compounding pressure of a deadline, you know, mm-hmm. makes it so that I am working a lot leading up to it. So
yeah.
sometimes I do, right now I'm not on a revision, uh-huh. you know, I turned it in. So now this is why we're finally meeting, which is like really great. Thank you for coming. But that's when I cram in all the time. And I kind of go back and forth between being really hectically busy with writing or being hectically busy with the editing. Yeah. But I mean, I should be like totally honest that this is not to like martyr myself, but I kind of don't have a life. Like, it's really, I think it works for me how much I work because I'm pretty sure I'm a workaholic, but I don't suggest it for other people unless they know that they need to write. But
yeah.
for me, it was when I finally discovered it and found a schedule that worked for me, it felt like I had something to come home to and I didn't mind. I love my friends and family and I still see them and I miss them a lot. And mm-hmm. it's sad to miss out on some of these things, these social engagements, but also I got this thing I'm doing.
Yeah. You're it's contracted really, to do really, another thing.
Yeah. Not just that's absolutely true because I do think it's like really important for kind of people like listeners to know that it's not, there's things that sound good on paper and, mm-hmm. and it's really romantic to have a book deal, but it's also the flip side is guess what? You're on contract and you have to do this thing or you don't get paid. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I tell my contributors. I say, you do not get paid until this is done.
Yeah. It's a thing. It's how it works.
So you might want to prioritize getting it done.
Yeah.
You want to get paid.
Yeah.
Just saying. Oh, that's it. Because I was talking to some other people and it's also, we're kind of the same ilk of, I go to my full-time job, mm-hmm. and then afterwards, I just want to do whatever I need to do, and maybe that's going to a reading, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But hopefully, it's more so writing. And then after that, it's like, I don't want to meet new people and do things or go on a date.
Yeah.
It's like, I really should, but I don't want to.
I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's like, there is this, I know that we're like not sounding super healthy right now. And I'm not going to, like, excuse that or, you know, backpedal or anything. I think that's probably true. But I also just think that, yeah, when you say that there's a certain ilk of people, I don't – this is really important to me.
Yeah.
You know? It's something I've wanted for my entire life, and I get to do it, and the process isn't perfect, and it's messy, mm-hmm. and it's heartbreaking sometimes. But also it's just – it's – I get really ecstatic about it too. It's cool, you know.
Yeah, you have a book out. Speaking of,
yeah,
let's talk about Empress of a Thousand Skies came out in February.
Yes.
The sequel, Blood of a Thousand Stars, is coming out next February.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about those books? Because you've gotten very good reviews. The first book has been compared to Red Rising and Firefly. Bofengs, I'm big fans of. So it's on my stack. So I'm really interested to know more about the book, where it's going. Obviously, you can't do spoilers and all that stuff. But with that kind of comparison, especially to content created by men and white men, what did you expect when you were writing it? And how did you kind of put that to the page?
So you guys didn't see me, but she said you're building a fan base, and my eyes lit up. I was like, "Oh my god, say it again!"
But, you're building a fan base.
There are a lot of things I want to talk about. I'm trying to think where I should start. So, what was I trying to do? What were my expectations? I had very, very low expectations for who would read this book.
I think that's healthy. I was telling someone else, I'm like, I have very low expectations when I submit stuff. And then when you win and you get good reviews, you're like, this is great.
Everyone's been so supportive. But, you know, I mean, part of it is that, yeah, people love to say they love science fiction. and yes, there is kind of this either canon science fiction, old science fiction, or there's newer science fiction, but it is kind of blockbuster white dudes running around, shooting things, being buff. I don't know. I mean, that like this.
It's like cowboys in space.
Yeah. And that ethos, I mean, I think that's a really interesting comparison, because that even when you like think about cowboys and you think about expansion in the Wild West and Manifest Destiny, that's like, that's what it is. It's kind of colonizing space. That's what makes space operas, I think. That's what makes them so widely appealing, is that it kind of taps into this kind of not just curiosity, but like a need to dominate this unknown. And like that said, I'm really attracted to that too. That's I'm not above that desire or that need or that interest. I'm attracted to all of these properties that my book has been compared to, and I'm so flattered by them. But it's not even like I set out to do some intersectional novel about brown kids in space. It was more like, oh, I'm going to write these characters who remind me of people who I grew up with. And I grew up in Los Angeles, and it was, obviously there were instances of difficulties and racism, but it was, so that conversation started to evolve when you and I got older and went to college and started moving around the country and examining my own privilege in terms of being, because again, like I've experienced lots of racism as a child up until now, but I also know that my parents are both college educated, that they came over during the brain drain, that there was a lot of privileges afforded to me that many other POC and Black people like do not get. And so, you know, when this started to fall into place, and I've outlined many novels before this first one that got published, but it was always a theme, was kind of the ways in which society is arranged and rigged. I always try to write about that, whether or not it be fantasy or sci-fi. I wanted to write about these kids who were not inherently at odds with each other, because I don't think racism is inherent, but kind of had, because of the structure of their society, been raised to believe that each other was the enemy. And I think that's a very kind of common trope, and I wasn't like reinventing the wheel or anything. When I started thinking about the characters, I started thinking about Ri, who is kind of grafted off of an Asian, who is Asian, even though there's not like Asia or Africa in the society. Like, there's no one-to-one comparison, but Ri is Asian to me for intents and purposes.
Does that make it harder to even write POC when you can't kind of verbalize, and they're African-American, and Mexican-American?
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, too, is I actually feel like I had early readers who meant well, but some of their criticism was that it was too political.
I'm sorry. Have they read much sci-fi?
That a version of like pedantic. You know, whatever. I think everyone's entitled to their opinion, and that's fair. That's what I was intending to do, is kind of taking the action and kind of the scale of the properties that I loved growing up, and then just making characters who looked like me and my friends.
In regards to, because I've read Red Rising, and I've seen Firefly, and it was just so nice to, it's nice any time I see a woman and a woman of color kind of enter this area of genre lit, you know, let me use the air quotes when I say genre lit. because of all the crap we hear with the Hugos and all these mm-hmm. awards, and how there's just these certain amounts of people who get to break that barrier every time. And the same names are said all the time. So do you find yourself as author kind of navigating that realm, specifically the kind of sci-fi realm, or more so the young adult realm, and they don't kind of intermix? Because I can't name a lot of authors, and that's my own ignorance also, who also do sci-fi, you know, like shit ton of fantasy, a lot of romance, or maybe it's the categorization. But yeah. Sci-fi, it's kind of like you and Pierce, Marissa Meyer, mm-hmm. like the same kind of names come up.
Well, I'm flattered to be named in the same breath as both of them. But I think that my community, the community that supported me the most, mm-hmm. from which I draw a lot of my personal and professional friends mm-hmm. and acquaintances, is the YA community. Mm-hmm. I love being here, which is not to say I'm trying to reach out and go to more kind of sci-fi conferences and mm-hmm. fantasy conferences. Mm-hmm. But I think that also it could be my difficulty to break into these spaces is it could be read as me not trying hard enough, which is fair. But I also think that there's something to be said about the hierarchy even within genre lit. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So this isn't sci-fi for adults, even though I think that it is. But yeah, my characters are teenagers. I see it in people's faces when I say that I'm writing sci-fi or I'm writing YA sci-fi versus that. Mm-hmm. The kind of two mm-hmm. designations of it, kind of one seems, because I think unconsciously people are associating sci-fi with kind of canon white dudes, mm-hmm. you know, doing things and kind of a woman breaking into that space rather is interesting. Whereas when I say that I'm writing like YA sci-fi, then it's just like, oh, there are lots of women YA writers, you know? And so it's a weird matrix mm-hmm. of things to consider. And I am happy to be part of both, mm-hmm. but I do feel like I don't necessarily at this point have, it's like breaking into publishing for the first time almost, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. like as someone who is an editor for children's books and has been in kid lit packaging for, you know, 5-6 years or however long I was doing it. There's a familiarity with kind of the world. And, mm-hmm. and again, I'm on Twitter and I'm like, oh, okay, these are my people. As someone who is a publishing professional, I still really have no idea how to access the adults.
Readership.
Sci-fi readership, yeah. You know, yeah. And I would like to. It's just like man, I don't even really know where to start. Yeah. You know,
it seems like there are these designations, and even, I mean, for me, I write cross genre. Mm-hmm. You know, like I write nonfiction, I write fiction, I also write for young readers, and I write adult.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, like some of my protags will be teens looking, you know, or adults looking back as teens and how you take that, because, you know, it's a different level of perspective. I was talking to Madhuri Pavmani about it, of how do you reach us as readers, but then when you're the creator, how do you reach those other readers, because you're trying not to necessarily pigeonhole yourself.
Yeah. And I really don't mean to sound disparaging about like the adult kind of sci-fi readership, because the ones who I do interact with in these public spaces, whether I'm at mm-hmm. a conference or on Twitter, I think they're super welcoming and open, and they're great. And sometimes I get put on roundups, and I'm really and boost the hell out of it whenever
yeah,
I can.
Yeah.
But it's, I think that this is kind of a deeper industry mechanism of mm-hmm. like how books get distributed and marketed and
yeah.
things like that,
yeah.
you know?
And it's a stringent fan base. I feel like that is a very ardent fan base,
mm-hmm.
the hardcore sci-fi, I guess adult readers, if we put them in that realm, are really like the ardent ones who keep coming to pass and saying, no, but Lovecraft. You know? That's not looking at his personal politics.
Right.
Just
look
at the art.
Avatar, just like misogynist. Yeah. There can be some readers in that kind of market who are very idealized the the days of yore when people were like really exploring space and finding green dudes and stuff, you know, I don't know.
Which is fun.
I mean, yeah, we've talked about like a really, really like large spectrum, I think. The short answer is I don't know how to break into that market, but I would like to. If anyone has any ideas, let me know.
There you go.
Keeping on the book kind of track, but also into the editor track, is I feel as though you can't separate a book from how it's promoted. Because it's out of your hands, you as creator, and then it goes into the world, however a publisher or you if you're self-publishing, but it is packaged in a certain way once it goes to the public. And from the author's end, we're worried, I think, about the story itself. And we have to consider the business end of how it's sold and how it's seen. And I've seen books that are very well written, marketed wrong.
Yeah.
As in, it was the cover made it feel, it was a thriller, and the cover made it feel more sci-fi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or it was coupled with a book that was another genre, so people assume that both books were of the same genre, and then they read that book, and they're like, oh, I like it, I just wasn't expecting this.
Right.
So that dominates the conversation
is that you didn't, you, Royal You, like, did not set up the reader expectations in such a way because of the way it was packaged.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have control of that
Absolutely.
As an author.
Mm-hmm.
So how much do you as an author advocate for yourself to your publisher versus you as an editor advocating for your authors in-house?
Ooh, okay, well, I think it changes from project to project. Mm-hmm. I will say that Brazier Bull's my publisher for Empress and Blood. They've been really nothing but accommodating. I really felt taken care of and that my concerns were heard. And I ended up really loving my cover, which I thought was like a really big step because I know that that's happened across the board. I'm not super plugged into, I am aware of what they're doing and I know where my book ends up and I know I've seen it at conferences. I know where the galleys have floated around and that there were certain ways in which they supported the book that I really, really appreciated. But again, I think one of the questions is like how this loops back to how to open it up to other audiences past like the YA audience, right? Because I think that my book is a little bit of a cipher. There's some romance in it, but I think that there's not a lot. So then they're just like, well, it's not sci-fi romance, but it's not this, it's not that. I think that people, it hits like a couple of notes, it being like diversity and political and space.
Mm-hmm.
And
those kind of sub-Amazon categories where it's like, it is the number one book in political
intergalactic space thrillers. Yeah, but you know, I mean, I think that I would like to advocate more for, you know, maybe more events or more marketing to like the adult market. But I also, but this is when the editor in me steps in because I know that there are plans, long-term plans for every book and every author.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope. That's what we do, like at my job, that's where we want, it's a slow build. It's not we can't go out with every book having everything that we want for it or that the author wants for it. So I think that it's a really delicate balance of figuring out how to build the author and the brand like long-term. So I think that it worked out. I really appreciate what Razor Bull has done for me so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to see what happens with Blood. But, you know, I think as an editor, as I'm advocating for my books, I mean, it starts really early, like you said. I mean, it starts like as soon as we bring in the acquisitions materials, right when we get the book, then we're just like, God, I really love this. And you're talking about like as much as you can. Then you edit it. It gets to the point where other people can read it. Then we do a thing called a launch in-house where... Mm-hmm. Where we talk about your book, you know, 6-8 months out and try to get people excited about it. And that's when we start assigning publicists and marketing people and stuff like that. So it's really, really a very large machine that I'm only a part of.
Yeah.
I think that I do a good job at collaborating with authors to get the manuscript where we want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, as you know, then it goes through all of these other different processes, and then also other people have to read it and love it too and talk it up, and then we figure out the placement and where it goes and what makes the most sense. And there's just like, there's so many things. So I can advocate all I want, and I really actually do. And people in house are very good about kind of listening and making sure that I'm heard.
Good.
Sometimes you don't get everything you want for a book. And that's okay, because there's like a little bit of like tit for tat. Well, okay, well, we didn't do this, but we're going to do this for this author. This is the conference we can maybe send the books to. You know, there it's a negotiation for sure.
Yeah. I'm in those launch meetings.
Yeah.
They can be long.
Longer
for the acquisitions editor than anyone else.
It's long. It gets long for sure.
Yeah. And that's where it seems like everyone's getting a sense, like you say. And for you, you said people get assigned. So is there several publicists in the room, and then one gets assigned, or one has been assigned and comes to that launch?
Oh, no, I think that there are, I don't know if like it's common to have more than like one publicist, like on a project, you know, like I think that you have like your point person. Is that what you mean?
No, like at that launch, because I work for a very small publisher. So we only have the one publicist, the one marketing manager.
Oh,
so
they're
always in every meeting.
Right. Yeah. So there's a team of marketing and publicity people. And so then that's like how they kind of figure out where they're going to go and after the launch, you know.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Is when their teams kind of divvy up and assess what makes the most sense and who's going to go where and stuff like that. So,
oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Cool. And Razorbuild, they kind of have their own presence. So I kind of know what I'm getting from Razorbuild. I know I'm not going to get Sarah Dessen from Razorbuild. When you know that your imprint has a certain kind of presence, so you know whether or not yours is a fit for that, or whether they're trying to broaden their presence.
Because the new editor
came, and they kind of like, oh, well, this is what I want to do that isn't on the beaten path of what we've done before. That comes into consideration as well for you as author?
Yeah. I mean, I like the name check of like saying that I'm at Razorbuild, and I like their books. I think they're commercial and splashy, and they have gorgeous packages. So, yeah, being an author there was a very exciting, and still is, a very, very kind of exciting move for me to make, to be there and kind of see. They publish great authors, and they publish great sci-fi, too, which was, you know, part of what made them really attractive. And
but when yours is this specific identity of dark, fantasy, sci-fi, and that's where you fit, perhaps that can help with the kind of scenario I presented earlier of, oh, well, I thought your book was this, but no, because I know Razorbuild, I know that your book is probably in this category.
I mean, I think that's true, but I would actually also say that most readers
may not pay attention to imprints.
They don't even know what imprints are, you know?
I do come at this from a very publishing perspective.
Right, of course.
Like,
well, no, I mean,
oh, is that so-and-so? No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously we would come from a publishing perspective, and, you know, hence the name of the podcast. But I also, as an editor and as a writer, too, like across the board, I'm always trying to remember that person, that younger reader who's just like, publishing's a thing and I can get into it. Like, there was no... I was a voracious reader, and I would not be able to tell you. I think I recognize like the Penguin logo.
Scholastic, obviously.
Yeah, Scholastic. Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant.
I mean, and then to even differentiate by imprints within publishing houses, that just like that was not a thing that I knew to do yet. Which is why I think that, you know, for my day job for editing at Macmillan, our imprint's called Imprint. Which sounds kind of nutty to a lot of people in publishing, but the kind of logo and the idea of making your mark and, you know, books making their mark. And also it's just like somebody outside of publishing is just like, oh, imprint. I get that. Whereas quite honestly, like someone outside of publishing, if I'm like, oh, Razorbuild published me, they'd be like, what's that? What's a Razorbuild? That's a thing? It's a bird? I'm confused, you know?
That is the logo, by the way.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, there are multiple ways to look at it. Again, I love being a Razorbuild author, but I also think that, like, outside of it, people are just like, I don't know what that is. But I do think that it helps when you start to think about kind of the distribution and the branding and yeah. like how you think your book is going to be packaged.
Yeah.
I really do trust like my publisher through and through, you know? Yeah.
That's my advice to authors is pay attention to who's publishing what you like. Because everyone says, oh, go to the acknowledgement page and look at who their agent is.
Yeah.
I was like, look at who the publisher is too and how they did the job on the book and how you heard about it, if you interacted with them.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I would also add to that, like, not just like as in the publisher, like publishing entity, but like mm-hmm. find out who the publisher of that imprint is, like the person who has the name like publisher or executive editor mm-hmm. on it. Mm-hmm. It's really, if one of those people is on the editorial call, that's a thing. Because editors leave jobs, but publishers don't leave their imprints, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially when their name is on it.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah. Take that as you will. But yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Rhoda, for being on the podcast.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. This was really fun. It's really hot in here because we don't have an air conditioner on, and you've been such a trooper.
actually, the sun went down, so that helped a lot.
Yeah, and thank you, everyone, for listening. I appreciate it.
How may people get in touch with you, get your book, find out more about you?
Yeah, hey.
Not to pitch you.
No. But I'm into it. I'm most active probably on Twitter or Instagram, mm-hmm. and that's at Rhoda B. So R-H-O-D-A, B as in boy, E-E, two E's. And then also, and you can find my website, which is new, and I just launched it, and I keep forgetting to send everything.
Congrats.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
I just assume you had one.
Yeah. Shout out to my friend Angela Velez, who designed it for me and insisted that I get one because she's a publicist. And mm-hmm. she's like, I cannot. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can download the cover there. Maybe both of them. But anyway, but check out Twitter, and that's, like, kind of a good launch point for any of my other things.
JustYourName.com.
Oh, yeah, RhodaBiesa.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yay. Don't pitch her. Have your agent pitch her.
Yeah.
But don't pitch her. I always do this caveat because I'm like, they're cool. They're not that cool.
That's true.
Unless specifically asked. Yeah.
Sure.
But thank you again, Rhoda, for being.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
And thank you all for listening. Again, this is the Minorities in Publishing podcast. It can be found at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and Minorities in Pub on Twitter, as well as Google Play now and iTunes. Thanks so much, and see you next time.